Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and I'd like to thank you all for tuning in, be this your first ever episode or if you've managed to listen to a few in the past. Today's episode we'll be looking back at a fantastic album which is relatively young compared to a lot of the albums that we do on the podcast, and that is Arctic Monkeys' Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. And it was only released in 2006, the oldest album, or the youngest album, I should say, other than this one previously, would probably be a bit of a dead heat between OK Computer by Radiohead, which we covered in episode 2, and Time Out of Mind by Bob Dylan. And both those albums were released in 1997. This is the first album that we've done on My Classic Album that was recorded this side of the millennium, but it very much is a classic album, and it's got a really unique story to it as to kind of how it came about and the reasons why it's such a renowned and classic album. And my guest, Ben Dunbreck of Inner Groove Records, will be joining me to talk about that. He was kind of in the midst of that Arctic Monkeys fandom and what that was like for an Arctic Monkeys fan in 2006 and 2005. So that's coming up in just a little bit. If you enjoy My Classic Album, I would love it if you joined any of our social media pages. So we have a Facebook and Instagram and a Twitter page, as well as a YouTube channel. So if you get on Facebook, if you have it, and you search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page, I'm always trying to post music-related stuff on there, and it's usually the first port of call for kind of updates about the podcast and albums and guests that are coming up in future months. So again, just search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page, and that's you part of the Facebook community. If you search for My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram and follow the page, again, I tend to update that quite a bit. And also, if you get yourself onto Twitter, at @MCA_podcast and follow us on Twitter, that's still kind of getting off the ground. It's not really a social media network that I use a lot, but it is something that I'm trying to get into more. So @MCA_podcast. And any of those are great just to kind of give me feedback on the podcast, albums that you'd like us to cover, maybe guests that you know are interested in being on the show, anything like that. Any of the social media channels. And of course, we've now got a YouTube channel as well. So My Classic Album with Mike Norris, where there's going to be like album reviews, gig reviews, that sort of thing. Previews and reviews of previous and upcoming episodes. There's anything related to the podcast that I can kind of put into video form rather than written form, you'll find on the My Classic Album YouTube channel. So get yourself on any or all of those, and you'll always be up to date with what's going on with My Classic Album. And of course, if you need any more of this information, just get yourself over to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk, where all the information and all of our previous episodes are on, from The Beatles, Revolver, right up to Sweet Baby James that we covered last month, and indeed today's episode for Arctic Monkeys. But before we delve into this month's classic album, I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about Amy Macdonald's show at Newcastle City Hall on the 11th of April. Now, anyone who listens to the podcast will know that I'm a big fan of Amy Macdonald. I reviewed Under Stars on a previous episode, which is our latest album, and this is the Under Stars tour that did a lot of dates around the UK. It was a pretty big tour. Now, the last time I'd seen Amy Macdonald was at the Sage in Gateshead, which must have been at least 4 years ago. I think it was 2013. And, I mean, the Sage is a beautiful venue. A brief side note, if you ever get an opportunity to see a band or a singer in the Sage, you absolutely need to take it, because it's just a phenomenal venue. On this occasion, Amy was playing Newcastle City Hall, which I believe was the first time that she's played that venue. She usually plays kind of the O2 Academy. So this is kind of, again, when you're thinking about the hierarchy of venues in the Northeast, it's kind of like a step up again. And the album has done really well. I think the album reached number 2 on the UK album charts. And Amy was touring with Newton Faulkner this time. And Newton Faulkner is someone that I've wanted to see for a long time. So they both burst on the scene at around the same time. I'm sure it was around 2007 that both Newton Faulkner and Amy Macdonald kind of came on the scene. And for a long time, I've thought, I'd love to see Newton Faulkner live. I think he's got this really kind of unique way of using his guitar, which I just wanted to see in person. I just wanted to see what that was like. So my wife was meant to be coming with me to the show, but unfortunately she wasn't able to, and she was absolutely devastated to miss the chance of seeing Newton Faulkner. But that meant that my friend Rick could come along as well. So Rick was up from Dance AF. And he basically, I said to him, I've got these tickets going, Newton Faulkner, Amy Macdonald, and would you like to go? Now, he'd heard of them both, but I don't think he could have named you a song by either of them. But I think he just liked the idea of just, you know, me and him getting something to eat, catching some live music. It just, you know, it was a really nice evening. So Rick came along for the ride. Newton Faulkner, I'm going to touch on him first, because usually, you know, support acts are great, and that's how I've discovered so many of the bands and singers that I love. But they don't usually get much of an opportunity to kind of like shine. But it was literally Newton Faulkner on the stage with his guitar and some pedals. And he kind of came on. It was a very kind of low fanfare, just kind of, hello, I'm here, let's get started. And he had the entire room's attention from the word go. And I think what's cool is, again, when you're talking about support acts, not everybody turns up for the support act because they know that they've got a bit of time. They can maybe have another couple of drinks. They could maybe sit out later because they're not bothered about the support act. Some people are, of course. But what I will say for Newton Faulkner is that City Hall was pretty much full when he came on. You know, I think there were about four people in the seats in front of us that hadn't turned up yet. And I looked around and I couldn't really see many, if any, more spaces. And Newton Faulkner came out. And it was a great mix of kind of the songs from his first album, Hand Built by Robots, and kind of stuff from the rest of his career that maybe people hadn't heard. I know that I've got that first album, and I have kind of followed his career, but I wouldn't say that I knew a lot of the songs he was performing, but I really enjoyed them. He's currently on recording his latest album, and what I really liked, and it was quite brave in some ways, but it was kind of a good indicator of what the set was like. He sort of said, I've got these songs that I haven't finished yet. He did this on like a couple of occasions in the set. He said, I've got this song, I haven't finished it yet. Would you like to hear it? And then he would play you a verse and a chorus and he'd go, right, well, that was that one. Which, it was quite interesting because it's really cool to hear something that's kind of still in progress. And the way the Newton Faulkner works, I imagine, he wanted to hear a reaction to how that song came across as to whether he thought he was going to include that on the album or whatever. The highlight for me, possibly, being a Queen fan, as most listeners of My Classic Album will know, is at the end when he did his own version of Bohemian Rhapsody. So again, it was just him and his guitar and his pedals, but he did this like really cool, all-encompassing version of Bohemian Rhapsody. And the thing is, as a Queen fan, or just as a music fan, people have heard a million and one versions of Bohemian Rhapsody, and this was a unique and funny version. It was done for laughs, and it was just great, and it was great to finally tick Newton Faulkner off kind of the gig bucket list. And I know that he's doing a UK tour towards the end of the year, and I might see if I can get tickets for me and my wife, because I know she was really looking forward to seeing him, and she was disappointed that she didn't get the chance. And I mean, Rick from Dance AF, he enjoyed it. He really enjoyed the show. He really enjoyed Newton Faulkner, and he really enjoyed Amy McDonald. So obviously Amy McDonald was the main attraction. And I mean, as always, I mean, did you really think I was going to say anything bad, really? Like, it was a really good show. But you know what I liked about it is that, similar to the album, it's the same kind of message. So Amy McDonald's always, you know, she's a solo artist, she's written her own music, and you previously I felt that you were watching a solo artist on stage performing those songs with a backing band, whereas when you listened to Under Stars and when you saw Amy and the band on this tour, you felt like you were watching a band in some ways. So it's a much more collaborative effort. They were kind of stronger emphasis on backing vocals, which is something that I really like, kind of harmonies and backing vocals. So I think that has to do with something. She's got this like great love of Bruce Springsteen and all these kind of classic artists. Like, I've been to at least two tours of hers where she has performed an acoustic version of a Bruce Springsteen song. On this occasion, she did the Doobie Brothers Listen to the Music, which was awesome. But I don't know, when you think of Bruce Springsteen, like, the band is just as integral on stage as he is, and I think that maybe she's trying to capture a bit of that. And it is more of a collaborative process, and it worked really well. Like, it was a really strong set, a really good mix of new and old. And, you know, I mean, I love the first album. I think the sign of a really good live show is if you've listened to the new album and you have your favourites and you have some you're less bothered about, and then you go and see songs from that album performed live, and when you come away, you have a new appreciation for the studio versions. So a really good example of that on this occasion is the song she's currently got as her current single, which is Automatic. So when I first listened to Automatic, I didn't dislike it, but I thought there were stronger songs on the album. But I must confess, in the 2 or 3 weeks since I saw her live, that's the one that's been stuck in my head the most. And I think that's testament to the way they performed it live. And I've read loads of gig reviews from the tour, and I know that most of them were really strong. I think it was Inverness that apparently there'd been like some really kind of rowdy fans who were just chatting and not listening, and it had pissed her off and stuff. That's a really interesting review to read, actually, because that, I think that was the next night after we'd seen her in Newcastle, and the Newcastle show had been like really great, and then she'd obviously gone to Inverness and not been hugely happy with these kind of chatting people that she could hear, like that were picking up on like her headphones and that. So it just shows that kind of from one date of a tour to the other, kind of how an audience can kind of change a show and how important we are to the whole presentation of live music. And yeah, so just a little bit of a ramble there, but I really, really enjoyed her show, as I always do. She's doing some shows in the summer, a different kind of, I think she's doing one down London, she's doing a few kind of festivals here and there, and then she's playing two nights in the Barrowlands in Glasgow at the end of the year. So I would thoroughly recommend, if you have the opportunity, to go and see her. But I guess that you knew I was going to say that. Under Stars is out now, and if you would like any more prompting to buy the album, you can, of course, go on the My Classic Album YouTube channel, or listen back to episode 8 of My Classic Album, where I talked about the Under Stars album. And that's pretty much all I've got to say on that. Right, so let's get down to business. Episode 10 of My Classic Album is about Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not by Arctic Monkeys. Before Ben Dunbrecht joins me to break the album down, here's a little fact burst. Here's what you need to know about Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not is the debut album from English rock band Arctic Monkeys and was released on the 23rd of January 2006. The album was recorded across various studios in the summer of 2005, including Chapel Studios in Lincolnshire and Two Fly Studio in the band's hometown of Sheffield. After building a strong fan base through their must-see live shows and a growing online community on social network MySpace, the band was signed to Domino, an independent label also home to Franz Ferdinand. Jim Abbas and Alan Smith were behind the production desk as anticipation grew for what people hoped would be a great album. To build further anticipation, the band released I Bet That You Look Good on the Dance Floor as their debut single in October 2005. The single reached number one on the UK singles charts and established Arctic Monkeys as the next big British band. Dance Floor sold over 600,000 copies, certifying platinum in the UK, while NME called the track the seventh greatest song of all time in 2016. When the Sun Goes Down was released the week before the album's release, and also reached the top spot in the UK. Fake Tales of San Francisco, meanwhile, was released as a radio-only single in the US, as the band attempted to crack both sides of the Atlantic. First day sales of Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not in the UK outsold the rest of the top 20 combined, and by the end of the week it had become the fastest selling debut album of all time, selling over 360,000 copies. Naturally, the album reached number one in the UK as well as the US, Australia and Ireland. Critically, the album was quickly hailed as a modern classic and topped many publications' end-of-year lists. NME went as far as to call Arctic Monkeys our generation's most important band. Whatever People Say I Am won the Q Award for Best Album, as well as the Mercury Music Prize in 2006. The album has only grown in esteem since then. Rolling Stone named the album 371st, and its 500 Greatest Albums of All Time in 2012, while MTV named it the 9th Greatest Album of All Time in 2009. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. And I have here with me the owner, the proprietor of Inner Groove Records, Mr. Ben Dunbrecht. How's it going?
Not too bad, thank you.
Brilliant. So I guess the first question to ask is, why have you selected Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, to talk about today on My Classic Album?
It's hard to narrow it down to one, really. I saw four or five in my head, and I suppose I chose this one. It came out just after I left school, so I suppose it was one of those sort of, you're 16, you've left school, it's one of those seminal albums, isn't it? Everyone seems to have one. They get transported back to the summer of the year. I know they were the next big thing. They were going to be, well, they still are, but they were going to be the next big rock and roll band. And I'd listen to them through, because everyone used to share their music on file sharing websites. So I'd known them for a couple of years, and then this album came out and their tour came out. And it was just mental. Every song's a hit. There's no bad track on it at all.
And I guess that's the thing. It's like, and you talk about it being an album that was just big at the time, like a seminal album. This album and this band were everywhere at that point in 2006. It's difficult because, unless you were kind of, particularly in the UK, unless you were in the UK at the time, it's hard to kind of explain just how much Arctic Monkeys were everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I would say, the scale of the 90s sort of Oasis and Blur, I mean, there wasn't, in my mind, there wasn't a band since then that quite had that effect.
Yeah, totally. So this is the first album that we've covered on My Classic Album that's been released this side of the new millennium. So 2006, it's only 11 years old. What has it done for you in such a short space of time that places it in the company of all these other classic albums?
I suppose it's like I say, I suppose what sort of topped it for me as being sort of my favourite album was the time it came out. So, like I said, I just left school, you're sort of going into the workplace or whatever you do. And my friend and I went to see them on the tour when they came down to Plymouth. Never been back since, unfortunately, but when they did come down. So I suppose also it all happened in such a short amount of time. You felt like you were on a journey with them. You had you had a couple EPs out before the album, and they were very involved with their fans. So I suppose when this album came out, it sounds stupid somewhere, I suppose, but it sounds like you sort of all went on the journey together because of social media, with MySpace and that, it just sort of peaked. And Arctic Monkeys were one of those bands that I don't think they're necessarily on MySpace, but a lot of fans sharing their stuff on there. By the time the album came out, a lot of us knew their music, but we were happy to buy their album. I mean, I think it was the biggest selling album since Oasis, I believe, if not bigger, in terms of sales in the first week. I think it smashed their record. And I think people just sort of wanted to give back what they had been given, because we'd been sharing it all for nothing. When it came to it, we were all like, well, we don't mind spending that 10 quid, and as it was then.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're talking about kind of the sales of it. It is the fastest selling debut album in UK history. It, on its first day of release alone, on the 23rd of January 2006, it sold 118,501 copies, according to Pitchfork.
Yeah, that's insane, isn't it?
Absolutely.
When you think of the sales nowadays, I mean, apart from the likes of Ed Sheeran, you just don't hear of record sales like that.
No, no. And a huge factor, as you've touched on quite a bit already, in the rise of Arctic Monkeys, is the power of the internet, as we'll call it. And we were still kind of getting to grips with kind of how the internet would change the music industry. Can you kind of continue to give us a bit of a small insight? Obviously, you're saying yourself that you used some of these sites, and how Arctic Monkeys fans used the internet in these early days of the band.
Well, I suppose the first person really was Lily Allen. I think she released her debut album before Arctic Monkeys, I believe. I think it might have been 2005. And hers was literally all down to MySpace. We didn't really know the impact. I mean, it was before Facebook. I don't think Facebook was around then. If it was, it wasn't like it is now. And I think because MySpace was geared up towards music, it's crazy. when you look back at it now, we take the internet still for granted. With musicians coming through, like with BBC Introducing, you have to upload, don't you, your music onto their sites to sort of like Catfish in the Bottom and people like that. And to think they did it before all that is pretty mental. That was sort of like the likes of the BBC and MTV and, you know, all these sort of things.
And I guess that's the crazy thing. I mean, you talk about Lily Allen. I mean, Kate Nash was another one, maybe a year or two later, that kind of used MySpace to build this kind of online fan base and then transfer that into a record deal. But before that, like at the turn of the millennium, when Napster was emerging, the internet was kind of viewed as like the enemy. So we always talk about Metallica. Metallica always the example that we use, that Lars Ulrich kind of wanted every single user who downloaded a Metallica song to be sued up the backside. But then there were these people like Arctic Monkeys, Lily Allen, Kate Nash coming through after exposure online. And MySpace, as you say, was the hub for all of that. Do you think that we were still learning about the way the internet was going to transform the music industry? Or do you think that we were pretty savvy at that point?
Maybe it's a generational thing, like say with Metallica and that. But I think we were sort of the first generation to grow up with the internet as not a luxury, really. I mean, everyone had the internet, especially by 61, by the time I see, what was that, 2005? Sort of, most people had the internet in their home. Most of us were sharing music. So I think we knew what it could do, but I don't think we were expecting the likes of, I mean, you look now with, like you're saying, Napster and that, but you look forward to streaming now with Spotify and with Napster again, they're back. Well, they're still around. And you've got Tidal and things like that, and the way they affect the charts now. I mean, I don't think anyone expected quite the impact it has.
Well, you know, and it's funny, I mean, you've been talking with me on the Facebook group for My Classic Album. We were talking a bit about Ed Sheeran and how now it's possible, thanks to streaming and downloading, to have an entire album in the top 20. And that's to think even 5 years ago, that was just probably unthinkable.
Yeah, I personally, I'm not convinced it's the right thing for the charts. But unfortunately, it seems to be the way it's going.
And yet, ironically, in an interview with Prefix magazine, the band said they were unaware of their MySpace site initially. And as you say, it had been kind of created by the fans, this opportunity to kind of share their music. It's also arguably, I mean, I'm sure there were forums and that around before then, but it was also arguably the beginning of online communities sharing a particular love of a band or a genre of music.
Yeah, definitely. But then, again, it's all folklore, I suppose, now. But they, at the time, they said they were encouraging people to share their music. So when they first, I think they first sort of started going live in 2002, I believe, and they were giving away like CDs and singles, like a lot of local bands do. And my impression is they were encouraging people to share it online. But like you were saying, they weren't aware of the MySpace page mm-hmm. at all for a while. I don't think they realised for quite a while what it was all about.
And I mean, let's not forget, and you've touched on this already, the band didn't even have a record deal at this point, and yet they're playing venues like London Astoria. That would usually be reserved for kind of bands that had record deals and were releasing albums. And it was merely from that word of mouth and the online community that couldn't get enough of them. So it meant that by the time that Arctic Monkeys were signed to Domino, they already had a huge fan base behind them. Now, you've said already you were part of that online community that broke the band. How did you kind of discover them in that sense?
I genuinely can't remember. They just sort of, I used to spend quite a lot of time on looking for music. And it was just one of those bands I came across, and you sort of give them a listen, and they just sounded different. You know, I can't think what it's called. It used to be called Scummy Man. I think it's when the sun goes down, it's officially called. Was sort of the first one I heard, and it was just, I'd never heard anything like it. The lyrics, sort of more poetry, it was incredible.
And again, it's very much about kind of the time that the album came out, that when we talk about earlier albums from the 70s and the 80s, and you're talking about people who were around at the time and they discovered them, very often it's that their parents were playing them or that they kind of discovered them singing somewhere. But it's this idea now that because of the way the internet has changed, you can't necessarily pinpoint when you heard someone for the first time, because it's so easy to access music now. Just hundreds, if not thousands, of new singers and bands that you can get into, potentially.
Yes, definitely. And like I say, there was not just MySpace, but sort of... like the torrent websites and things like that that were around back then. Oh, I should probably admit to it. But then, back then, people used to go on and you used to see sort of put the sort of music you liked into it, and whoever had sort of the most downloads, you'd download that and see what it sounded like, and if you liked it, you'd sort of get into it. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, by then, I don't know if it's gone back the other way because of streaming. A lot of playlists and that obviously revolve around the most played songs, who are generally the ones that are played by the likes of Radio 1, and all these sort of radio stations that essentially they pre-pick the hits, don't they? Before they come out, they say, right, we're going to put this on our A playlist, and that's going to get loads of exposure, and generally it tends to reach top 10, I would say, easy. So I think it's starting to go more back towards people aren't necessarily discovering new music. They're being told what to listen to again, in my opinion.
I think it's important to say that it wasn't simply their presence online that made the album a success. Now, you've touched on Oasis already. Not since Oasis do I believe a British band had kind of come into the public consciousness with such a huge bang. Yes. So, Jacob Stallworthy wrote in The Independent last year that at a time when most new music came in the guise of banal indie records from yet another post-Strokes knockoff, Whatever People Say I Am lurched out of your speakers, grabbed you by the esophagus, and demanded you to listen. How different did it feel to you when you first heard it? Were you aware that it was something special? Obviously, you'd followed the band for a while at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was one of the ones that bought it on the first day. My mum drove me to the nearest city to buy it because we lived in the country. Yeah, I mean, the days, the weeks leading up to it, you knew it was going to be big. I don't think necessarily as big as it did get. I mean, that's a mind-blowing amount in a day. The first day is just incredible. But we all knew it was going to be a massive thing. And we were just hoping that it was going to continue, and it wasn't going to be one of those ones where you go, oh, do you remember them? Yeah, they had a really good album. Whatever happened to them? You know?
Yeah.
Those people are quite fickle.
And I think it's funny because I was reading something about when HMV were, before the release of the album, there was a lot of anticipation for its release. And they'd said, oh, well, we're expecting numbers for someone like, the Kaiser Chiefs or Franz Ferdinand. It'll do well. It'll do modestly. And then obviously it completely exceeded, as you say, everyone's expectations.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't understand why they thought that, because if they'd listened to it, it's like you touched on earlier, they didn't sound like anything else at the time. I mean, that's no disrespect to the Kaiser Chiefs and Franz Ferdinand. I mean, Franz Ferdinand, in my opinion, one of the best bands to have come out of the 2000s. But they didn't. They just sounded completely different. There was nothing around like it, and I don't think they quite realised how much they talked to people. You know, so we're similar age groups as well. It's only sort of 5 years. I think they're only sort of 5, 6 years older than me. and a lot of my friends liked them at that sort of age. Like I said, there was just nothing around like it. It seems odd that they never anticipated quite the hit that they had.
So, I mean, I must admit that for me in 2006, I was so deep into more of kind of the hard rock and heavy metal scene. So yeah. Arctic Monkeys, at least for me initially, passed me by completely. But I think that's because I wasn't looking in that direction.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But you couldn't ignore them. Like, as I say, they were everywhere. And it was, I was at university when it came out. And in every bar or club you went into, Arctic Monkeys came on at some point. So
dancing shoes.
Yeah. So what was it about this album, in terms of the album itself, that an entire generation picked up on?
I think because it spoke to you. And you've got songs on there like Riot Van, and When the Sun Goes Down, and things like that. And you listen to them and you go, oh, actually, I'm, you know, like, especially things like Riot Van on a Friday night. You know, you see these sort of chaps trying to get in line and get kicked out and then try again. He was talking about everyday life that we've all experienced, we've all seen, might have been part of. And I think that's what helped it, because you could associate yourself with it. You could place yourself in there.
Absolutely. So lead singer and songwriter Alex Turner, from what we're talking about here, is a huge part of the band's success in this instance. So when reviewing Whatever People Say I Am in 2006, The Guardian, and I must say, it's really ironic to me when you think about kind of how this was very much for the youth and the masses, that a lot of the reviews and the quotes I've got are from newspapers like The Guardian and The Independent. Like, it's, but anyway, that's kind of a side point. The Guardian claimed that while bands like Coldplay wrote in vague generalities to reach the widest audience possible, the Arctic Monkeys re-established the generation gap by writing what they know. So, as you said, is writing and singing about getting drunk in nightclubs and scraps in taxi ranks, rather than trying to create anthems to be sung in stadiums. Is it this relatability that would stand the album apart from albums like Kaiser Chiefs and all the other ones at the time?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%.
So the name of the album actually comes from the novel Saturday Night and Sunday Morning by Alan Sillitoe. And Turner felt the name was appropriate and felt there were similarities between the novel and their album. He told Enemy, "It's good because the book is called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and that's kind of what the album is, so there's a link there. And also, there's a lot of people saying a lot of things about us, and you don't have control over it." He also said that many of the songs on the album, as we say, cover that part of the weekend, and they feature the same character. Is it fair to call Whatever People Say I'm somewhat of a concept album?
I've never really thought of it, to be honest. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Yeah, because it is, like you say, a lot of it is centred around the one person. They released a music DVD back in, I think, back in 2006. And it was When the Sun Goes Down, about the prostitution and all that. So yeah, I suppose it would be. I suppose it was especially when you compare it to the rest of the music they've done since, that there's not been sort of that biographicalness about any of their music again. Not quite in the way this has.
And again, the term concept album can sometimes, you know, I'm not exactly talking about kind of like The Wall by Pink Floyd or something like that, but it's, you know, that idea that there's, you know, there's a very definite theme running through it, and the fact, like, as he says, that the kind of the same character or a very familiar character is kind of featured throughout. So I guess that's where I was coming from with that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and also, like I say, you can place yourself in the shoes. You can imagine yourself in each scenario. You've probably come across half a dozen of the scenarios in the album. So, yeah, it's clever that what he's done.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
So, just before we go track by track, I want to touch on the album cover, because it is quite an iconic album cover, and it's one that garnered a lot of controversy when the album came out.
Yeah.
So, the story behind it is that they basically paid their friend Chris McClure to get absolutely wasted on a night out, and then take a photo of him. And that was the cover. Yeah. And so NHS Scotland famously condemned the cover and claimed it was glorifying smoking. But bearing in mind everything we've talked about, the themes of the album and the sound of it, do you believe that it's more of a visual representation of all these themes represented on the album?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You can't get away. 2006, was that before the smoking ban? I think it was.
I think it was, yeah.
So he sat indoors having a fag on a Friday, Saturday night. There's nothing more sort of linked to it that sort of creates an artisticness about it than that.
I think glorifying it, that's something I definitely disagree with, because he certainly doesn't look like he's having a good time on that photo. You know, he's absolutely wasted, you know, and
but then they don't listen to the music, they just make assumptions. They think, oh, they're a famous rock and roll band, they've got blow smoke on the front, that means thousands of kids now are gonna want to go and smoke. Mm. Well, that's just not the case ever.
So now seems a good time as any to go track by track. So obviously you know how this works. We'll get through each of them and probably wander off into random little conversations as we go as well. So our opening track is The View from the Afternoon. So it's not only the opening track on the album, it also appears on the EP Who the Fuck Are the Arctic Monkeys?
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but I wasn't sure if I was allowed to swear on your podcast.
Oh, yeah. No, that's fine.
They released that afterwards. They got a bit of slack thinking it got released very quickly. But they did it because of all the hype. Like you mentioned about the debut album name. Obviously, they released Who the Fuck Are the Arctic Monkeys straight afterward, well, within a few months afterwards, I believe it was, sort of as a don't believe the hype, don't get carried away sort of touch. So I believe that's why it was called that.
Yeah. So again, as you've touched on, Alex Turner says that this song is about the idea of kind of building yourself up on a night out or any kind of situation. But if you build it up, it's more than likely to lead to disappointment. So already, in my opinion, that's hugely relatable, because I've lost count of the amount of times where you're like, you know, the spontaneous nights out were always better than the ones that you planned 2 weeks in advance.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
So how does this song kind of open the album for you?
Well, it's like you say, it sort of just kickstarts it into the sort of, even though obviously they're very rocky songs, they're quite, well, there's a few, but the majority of them are quite dark and depressing scenarios that you come across. So I suppose this is sort of the first kick in the teeth of Welcome to a Friday Night in England.
Absolutely.
Especially in the north of England, from my understanding.
Very much so. Very much so. So, the track is a live favourite of the band, and from what I can gather, it's regularly on their set lists. NME described their live shows at this time as a spine-tingling choral experience.
Oh, their debut album tour, but yeah, it was, yeah, it's even now, just talking about it, I genuinely have goosebumps coming out of the back of my neck. Yeah, it's just incredible. It was all-consuming.
So you said you'd seen them in Plymouth, was that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so kind of what was that? So kind of if you would just like take us back for a moment and just kind of like what, obviously you kind of built up this anticipation to see this band, and you obviously there'll be rave reviews going on about their live show, and then you're getting the opportunity to see them arguably kind of at their peak at that point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was sort of halfway through the tour as well. So you sort of got to that sort of standard. Do you know what I mean? The first few shows are always a little bit ropey at times, and they might change the set list around a bit. Whereas by then, yeah, I mean, and the support acts were really good. Do you remember I think they were called the Little Flames?
Yeah.
They supported, and so did Reverend and the Makers, who were brilliant. I mean, they obviously went big a little while afterwards. So, and they were the sort of same genre of music. So by the time Arctic Monkeys came on stage, I mean, it was just electric, if not slightly violent, but mainly electric. There was a few injuries soon after they came on stage. There was a lot of pushing and shoving, and yeah, there was a time when it got a bit leery. They actually said on stage, you know, chill the fuck out, basically. But once it sort of all calmed down, yeah, I mean, just incredible. Just such a sort of a buzz, and the energy on stage was just incredible, incredible.
So we're already seeing themes established around people who live for the weekend and the nightlife in 2006 Britain. Do you agree that this song and the album in general kind of almost has like a sarcastic tone, and it's something that I think's sort of quintessentially British?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Yeah.
So the opening line, anticipation has a habit to set you up for disappointment in evening entertainment, has been theorised to be a cheeky comment about the furore and excitement about the album coming out. Do you get kind of the idea that obviously there was such this huge build-up for it, and it's this idea that, you know, the first line of the album is anticipation has a habit to set you up for disappointment.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. This kind of cheeky idea that it's like, well, you know, and obviously it wasn't, but this idea of, well, you know, this could be shit, don't get yourself too worked up kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It is a bit different. If people hadn't come across them then, and have sort of only come across them in the last few years, I don't think they would quite get the persona difference. I mean, you look at Alex Turner and that now, compared to 2006, it's just a world away. I mean, he's like a proper rock and roll star now, whereas back then, like I say, they just took it all in their stride. They didn't know if it would be one album. They didn't know if it would be 10 albums. They just sort of went with the flow.
So we move on to arguably one of the biggest tracks on the album, and that's I Bet That You Look Good on the Dance Floor. So in some ways, this is perhaps the definitive Arctic Monkeys song, which is difficult to say. I guess that fans would probably have different opinions on that. The track reached number one on the UK singles charts and arguably established the anticipation for the album's upcoming release. So The Guardian, again, said in 2015 that I Bet That You Look Good on the Dance Floor changed the music industry. What kind of impact do you think that song had on release?
I don't think they say changed the music industry. Would you agree it changed the music industry?
It's a good question. I think it's a very bold statement. And that's why I kind of threw it in there. I'm not 100%. I think the album changed the music industry because obviously we're talking about kind of the internet and all this sort of thing. Whether the song did specifically, I think that's it. That's another matter.
Yeah, but then I suppose I've never really been into sort of nightclub scene and that. I mean, especially then. I mean, I wasn't old enough to get into nightclubs, but even now, it's still played in nightclubs. Maybe it would be one of those first ones that sort of is from a rock band but gets played in nightclubs a lot and people can dance to, maybe. I don't know. It's a bit like Kings of Leon, Sex on Fire, isn't it? I mean, you just hear that all the time when you walk past a club. Whereas maybe, I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily say I wouldn't say it changed the industry, personally.
Interestingly, Alex Turner was quite dismissive of the song initially. So he told The Guardian, "It's a bit shit. The words are rubbish. The words are rubbish. I scraped the bottom of the barrel. It could be a big song, but I'd hate to just be known for that song." So do you think, do you think lyrically it scrapes the bottom of the barrel, or do you disagree with him on this one?
Oh no, I've heard a lot worse, and I've heard a lot worse from the Arctic Monkeys, but he's not their best work, but it's their commercial success. The best work's generally not, is it? I mean, like I say, Kings of Leon with Sex on Fire is probably their most successful commercial song. I mean, and they've got albums and albums and albums that are just filled with amazing songs. I agree, David Bowie with Let's Dance. You know, I just think it's commercial success isn't necessarily good success.
And again, there's something, and you touched on this earlier about compromising, that kind of, especially nowadays, that, you know, the radio stations and the music industry almost pick the hits, in that this is going to be on the A list, as you said, this is going to be on the B list. So it's that idea that sometimes the songs that the fans are going to love, the ones that probably do have a greater musical quality, aren't necessarily going to be the ones that get released.
Yeah.
So producer Alan Smith recalls hearing I Bet That You Look Good on the Dance Floor for the first time in the studio. He said they were very excitable. Every time they recorded, they'd just go hell for leather, faster and faster. I decided to use a click track for the beginning of the song. I said, stick to that, and I'll let you go off to the second chorus. Then I'll let you get fast. It gets more exciting because of that. Is this a kind of a good example of that kind of frenetic energy and that intangible quality that they had live at that point and on the album as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can hear it. You can just hear it in the way they're playing and in the way he's singing and getting it across, that to be in the studio at the time must have been mental. Must have been absolutely crazy.
Ben and I are just getting started, and I look at Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not by Arctic Monkeys. Coming up, why does the song Dancing Shoes give me major flashbacks to my university days? And which song's music video inspired the short film Scummy Man? That's all coming up right after this.
Do you enjoy My Classic Album but need more than your monthly fix? Join Mike over at the My Classic Album YouTube channel. Hear previews and clips from previous and upcoming episodes of the podcast, plus access exclusive content, including album reviews and special announcements. Don't forget to click subscribe so you never miss a video. For more information, go to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk or search My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook.
So if we'll move on to Fake Tales of San Francisco, this is one of the tracks from this album that first appeared on their demo collection, Beneath the Boardwalk.
Yeah.
Have you had an opportunity to hear Beneath the Boardwalk? Was that how you discovered the band?
Yeah, I don't. Unfortunately, I don't actually have a copy. But yeah, I've got it on my computer. It's one that I've carried through the years. I think it's the first one I actually downloaded from them.
So how does that initial Beneath the Boardwalk version of Fake Tales compare to kind of the polished, complete version that appeared on the album?
It's very raw. Well, personally, I prefer it, but it's not... I think if they released a whole album like they released Beneath the Boardwalk, I don't think it would have had quite the success it did. It was a very raw, done-in-a-bedroom sort of touch on it.
So, I mean, Fake Tales is an account of Turner's time working bar at Sheffield's Boardwalk venue. Clash Music talk about Turner seeing the bands that come on stage drenched in contrived identities, telling fake tales of San Francisco, an impotent cocktail of what they wished they were and what they thought the crowd wanted. At this point in their career, these sorts of bands and those contrived identities are surely the very antithesis of what the Arctic Monkeys were providing. Or do you get that idea more that maybe they... Because I know that you say now, obviously, that he is very much kind of the rock star.
And yeah, that... he plays up to it. I mean, I've never met him, but I don't genuinely believe he's actually like he portrays. I think that's all, like I say, it's like a character. Because they've always, if you look through all of their interviews and that, they're always playing something different in terms of characters. Mm.
So perhaps it's kind of this idea that the band were, at that point, an alternative to these kind of bands. And, you know, we've discussed, not necessarily the bands we've discussed, but we know there were a lot of bands around that time that came in with the swagger and this idea that they were, you know, these kind of sun-drenched rock stars.
Yeah, and there was hundreds of them. There was just hundreds and hundreds, well, not literally, well, there was just hundreds of bands around that were sort of trying to get on the back of the sort of the indie pop track. I mean, you had, obviously, like you mentioned, Kaiser Chiefs, Franz Ferdinand, you had the likes of Magic Numbers, obviously you had the Strokes, but arguably they kick-started it all. They sort of kick-started the gravy train almost, I think. You had like the Wombats and the Hoosiers, they all released this sort of indie pop trying to be the next big thing, and it just didn't work for any of them, really. I mean, the Kaiser Chiefs are still around, Franz Ferdinand is still going, but apart from that, there's not really anybody left.
Which is quite strange when you think about it, that when you think of kind of other periods of music. So, for example, at the moment, and it's a very odd comparison to make, but there's this real kind of resurgence of these kind of bubblegum pop stars and bands of the 90s that they all faded away. And then from the past sort of 3 or 4 years, they've all kind of come back. Steps have just announced an arena tour.
That's just ridiculous.
You know?
But, they're number one, I believe, aren't they? Or something? In the iTunes chart or something like that?
Very likely. Very likely. And I mean, that tour, I mean, I know there's certain dates. I know I've sold out. You know, so, you know, it's interesting that, or even kind of the glam metal bands of the 80s are still around, still touring, but that for a lot of these bands at this time, about 10 years ago, at least at the moment, they've kind of sunk without a trace, whereas bands like Arctic Monkeys and Kaiser Chiefs have very much stayed in the public consciousness.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm pretty sure the Wombats are touring this year, so it's their 10th year. The Feeling are still touring. Franz Ferdinand are still touring. They're still all out there, but they're not getting the same push they did 10 years ago. But then I don't think there's necessarily the appetite for it. Music's so diverse now. There's not really one genre of music that is up there all the time. It sort of chops and changes around a lot more now, whereas back in 2006, it was just guitar music was everywhere. And then just after that was sort of like the R&B, sort of Rihanna and all that sort of lot were the main thing, whereas you don't really get that now, do you, in my opinion?
No, I mean, I think that's the thing. At one point, it was all cyclical. And so, even though something went out of style, it would always kind of come back round. Whereas I think at the moment, yeah, there's not any particular thing that's in.
No.
It's just a bit of everything, and whatever sticks is whatever ends up in the charts.
And Ed Sheeran, obviously.
And Ed Sheeran, yeah. Ed Sheeran. And,
you get the same ones come back again and again. But then, again, I don't necessarily say that's a good thing. Well, it's good they come back, but I don't think it's a good thing they dominate us. Much they do.
So we'll move on to Dancing Shoes at this point. So we've been talking so much about Alex Turner, and I don't want to forget the rest of the band. So Dancing Shoes is a great example of how tight, yet how frantic they are on this album. And I've used that word before, but it's a really good one.
Yeah.
Nick O'Malley's bass on this song, for me, is a particular highlight. Can we just take a minute to talk about the sound of the band on the album?
Yeah, I mean, like you said earlier, it's a lot more polished. But not too polished that it becomes generic. They've let them keep their sound. But then Domino Records are very good for that sort of thing. because they had Franz Ferdinand on the label and people like that as well. So they tidied it up, but they didn't take away the individuality. But like you say, all four of them are just incredible. So you got Matt on drums, and you had Andy Nixon on as well, as didn't you? He left after the first album, or after the first tour. But they've been playing 4 years together, I think, 5 years together by the time this album came out. So I suppose after that amount of time, you do get very tight, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I found this song lyrically one of the most relatable in terms of where I was in 2006. So Billboard, Save Dancing Shoes. In this disco punk vision of single person hell, there's no communicating of any kind. Just a bunch of scaredy pants blokes pretending to dance instead of actually approaching the girls across the room. That just takes me right back. Like I say, I was maybe, well, when the album came out, I must have been in my second year of university. And it's just that idea of being frozen to the spot. And I didn't even like the music that was playing in clubs, because like you, I'm kind of more into kind of rock bands and that sort of thing. So I'm in these clubs with the horrible lights and the music, and there's a girl I like, but I can't go over. And that song just takes me right back to about 11 years ago. It's quite frightening, actually.
But then that's like I said earlier, I think that's what made it so popular, is that you can put yourself there, and you've all got memories of all of this happening. And I think, like I said, I think that's why it became such a big hit. And even now, like you're saying, 11 years later, you listen to that song and you can still get transported back to that one memory that you probably haven't thought about for 7, 8, 9 years. I think that's sort of the magic of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So our next track, which is surely up there for longest song title on my classic album history, which is You Probably Couldn't See for the Lights, But You Were Staring Right at Me. That's probably the only song title I can think of that's as long as that, is probably Objects in the Rearview Mirror May Appear Closer Than They Are by Meatloaf. So when you're on Meatloaf territory for your song titles, you know that they're getting on the long side. It's a great example of some of these hilarious song titles that litter the album. Do you think, and this is more just kind of from you as an Arctic Monkeys fan, are there any kind of other songs on future albums where they kind of bettered some of the crazy names that are on this album?
I can't think off the top of my head. I'm just trying to think what's on. I mean, arguably, the whole of their second album, none of the names make any sense. Favourite Worst Nightmare. But then lyrically, a lot of it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's just very loud and good.
Ciara Knight, earlier this year, and when I say earlier this year, that's for the benefit of people listening to the podcast. For me and you chatting today, this article is literally about 2 days old.
All right.
she ranked every Arctic Monkeys track across all five albums on joe.co.uk, and she rated this song very highly on her list, citing drummer Matt Helmer's contribution. She said, "This toe-tapping track shows off Matt Helmer's vocals from the outset, cementing him as not only one of the world's greatest drummers, but also a very complimentary vocalist to Alex Turner. It is an integral part of their debut album." Would you kind of agree with that statement of how integral it is to the album?
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of him, I mean, he is what he's got. I think I don't think he's necessarily appreciated now, but I think in years to come, people will see quite how good a drummer he is. Like you touched on, his vocals are surprisingly good for a drummer, especially one that plays the drums quite as hard and as fast and as sort of riotous as he does.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing that you forget sometimes. I mean, obviously in the studio, you have the benefit to record the vocals separately, but it's the idea, and I often think, and I always manage, or nearly always manage, to bring Queen into any conversation that I have about music. But it's that idea of Roger Taylor, who is a fantastic vocalist in his own right. And when you see him live, and especially now in the post-Freddie days, he'll sing a song or two from behind the drums.
Yeah.
And you've got to think, I mean, I've had a go playing the drums. I wasn't very good. But that's very impressive that you can kind of be able to keep a strong vocal while spending an evening absolutely pounding away at the drums.
Yeah, I've never attempted to play the drums. I think it's a lot more technical than people think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, to be able to do both at the same time takes some talent, definitely.
Yeah. So our next track is Still Take You Home. And I always try and pick a favourite track on the album, and this might actually be it.
Controversial.
It's certainly up there. That's interesting. That's interesting. Why would you say it's controversial?
It's just not what I think of. It's not what I think of being a favourite. I mean, you got When the Sun Goes Down, Mardi Bum, View from the Afternoon, Fake Tales, Dancing Shoes. There's sort of a lot of big, big tunes there. And I don't know if I've ever come across someone that says Still Take You Home's their favourite one.
Yeah. I think, you know, it is a bit of a hidden gem, as you say, when you kind of talk about all these other tracks. It is very much kind of hidden amongst all the rest. But again, it's something about kind of recognition, isn't it? So I was talking about how Dancing Shoes can take me right back to that moment. And again, it's almost a kind of idea. This song's exactly how I'd feel if I were the type to be out on a Saturday night now in 2017. So, I mean, I'm married. I didn't like going out in the first place, so I don't anymore. And, you know, there's some great lines in there, including, you know, you're a Topshop princess. I can't see through your fake tan. Do you think 11 years on that the type of people that we're encountering on this album are still just as prevalent in British nightlife as they ever were? I suppose that's a difficult question for me and you when we're not really out every Saturday night in the clubs.
Yeah. You don't have to go out on a Saturday night to see it, though, do you?
Well.
You go out in any major city and you can see these people are still around and yeah, you can see these people are still around. But yeah, I don't think it's changed. I mean, I can't remember the last time I went for a night out, but I don't believe it's changed dramatically in terms of the sort of people you come across.
I mean, it's instantly, and I mean, maybe it's because I'm from the Northeast, but instantly when we're talking about kind of can't see through your fake tan, Topshop princess, my mind immediately goes to Geordie Shaw, which...
Oh, yeah.
Which obviously, in 2006, you know, I think Jersey Shore, which it was inspired from, probably, I don't even know if that show was even out yet. So it's kind of this idea that the album, even 10, 11 years on, these kind of actors, it still keeps the album as current as it ever was in some ways.
Yeah, yes, it does, yeah. And like you say, especially now, I mean, I don't watch them, but there's a lot of those sort of programmes on now, isn't there? There's the Essex one, there seems to be a lot of people from there that are that way. Like you say, the Geordie Shore, I watch Virtually Famous, and one of the team captains on there, I think, is a Newcastle, obviously, girl. Doesn't have it down, does it?
I'm trying to think, I don't think I've watched it. I'm not sure.
She was in Vicky Patterson, is it?
Right, yeah.
I think she is the epitome, I suppose, of this song. She is somebody who, you know, she's on a game show on E4 and she dresses like she's going on a night out. She's a Topshop princess. She's the fake tan. She's boobs out and she looks a little bit terrifying, but, you know, it's Friday night.
So we'll move on to one of the kind of one of the more well-known tracks, which is Riot Van. And you've talked about Riot Van a couple of times already. So obviously 2006, that resurgence of vinyl hadn't happened yet. But again, if we were talking vinyl, this is opening side two, from what I can gather. Riot Van slows things down after six tracks of like full throttle. Do you think that kind of that's what the album needs at this point? Some time to kind of catch up with everything? Because this kind of maddening of the senses, and we just need a chance to sit back and just kind of take everything in that we've heard so far.
Yeah, maybe. I see it's my favourite track on the album.
Yeah.
Mainly, I think one of the main reasons, because it was the first song they played when I saw them. But, I think there's sort of an order to it, like you were saying, sort of the first track sort of kicks off in It's Friday, let's get ready, let's go out, let's have a good time. And sort of by side B, you're probably talking, what, half 10, 11 o'clock at night? You start seeing those people that have been drinking since 6, 7 in the evening, and the policemen are coming out. I think it's more of in my head, the album is sort of more of a time line to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's necessarily a case of, oh, we'll slow it down here. I think it's more a case of, oh, about this time, by now, there's usually some prat that's been arrested for being a knobhead, so... You know, it's half 10 at night, you generally see the first ones, don't you, by then?
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying that policemen kick people in, but, you know.
But I know, it's funny, it's almost something that, it's maddening to me that I've not kind of realised this until you've said it, that the album, not, obviously, you know, we've discussed how it is kind of about this culture, but that it is, in some ways, it's almost chronological, at least in some instances, and that's a really interesting point that I'd not really picked up in... It's quite obvious, really, when you think about it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll record this and frame that bit. Yeah, it does. It sort of peaks off towards the end. It sort of goes a bit more... Well, no, but then I suppose one of the last... I think the second to last track is When the Sun Goes Down, which, you know, is sort of meeting the prostitution side of things. So yeah, no, I'd say yeah, it is sort of in my head. It's more chronological in terms of time, throughout a weekend or an evening out.
Yeah. So Turner's lyrics are somewhat easier to digest with a slower tempo when you listen to it for the first time. And as we've been saying, Riot Van continues with this kind of Friday, Saturday night, Sunday morning theme that dominates the album. Do you think the laid-back nature of the song was kind of a sign of things to come on future Arctic Monkeys albums? So I'm thinking about a track like I Wanna Be Yours from AM, for instance, that it wasn't necessarily all going to be kind of hell for leather, bang, 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 every track, and that there was going to kind of be a bit of differentiation and a bit of growth from the band.
I don't know, because obviously, like I said, the favourite worst nightmare is pretty full-on, and like Humbug's quite full-on, whereas, but then the Arctic Monkeys AM's quite well-received, because I think it goes back to that sort of original sound a little bit more, not necessarily lyrically, but there is that mix of furious, fast playing, and then there are these sort of slower, like you say, you know, you got like Arabella and things like that on there that sort of take you back, maybe subconsciously, to that time.
So our next track on the album is Red Light Indicates Doors Are Secured, which another great name. So this one being broadly about catching a taxi at the end of the night. Billboard says of this track, the jabby guitar riff goes around and around as Turner fidgets in the back of a cab, drunkenly recounting two events from earlier in the night. A failed attempt to buy a girl a drink and an altercation in the taxi queue that turned violent. The song nearly ends with more disappointment and bloodshed, but the cab doors lock before Turner can leap out. Now, when I read about this song, or indeed kind of when people are trying to sum up the album, it's always referred to as kind of the song about fights in the taxi rank. So is that kind of paying the song a disservice when it's so witty and relatable to kind of just give it such kind of a throwaway description?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's if you actually listen to the lyrics, it's a lot more poetic, and I think people give it justice, definitely. I can't unscrew that.
So we've touched on everybody else, or most of the band, and now seems a good time to touch on guitarist Jamie Cook, who plays an absolute blinder on this track. How important are his indie influences? So he cites bands like The Smiths and Oasis. How important is that in kind of shaping the sound of the Arctic Monkeys?
I wouldn't necessarily say they... Well, obviously, if he says they do. But in my head, I don't. When I listen to Arctic Monkeys, I think of similar bands. The Smiths aren't the first band that come to my head.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd agree, yeah.
Oasis, I suppose, a little bit more. There is that little bit more sort of real-life spin to it. Some of their music was that sort of way, in the earlier days at least. But playing wise with Oasis, there's no doubt that there was inspiration taken from the style of playing.
Yeah. And I think as well, just thinking about the Smiths, it's kind of the one comparison that I could make, because I do think that they are quite different bands. I think the one comparison that I could make, and of course we talked with Nathan about The Queen Is Dead a few months ago, is that there's kind of very much a sense of realism from both bands. So Morrissey's very much into his kind of kitchen sink drama, kind of the common man. That kind of theme is obviously very prevalent in this album. Maybe not so much later in the band's history, but very much on this album.
Yeah, there is, yeah. I'm not really a massive Smiths fan, to be honest, so I don't listen to an awful lot of it, I must admit.
So our next track, again, must be one of the most popular songs on the album, Mardi Bum. So the riff of this is almost kind of quintessential Arctic Monkeys. And I don't know, I was going to ask you this. Do they use that on The Inbetweeners? Have you ever watched The Inbetweeners?
I've watched The Inbetweeners. I don't know.
Yeah.
In all honesty, I don't.
Because because I know it was that kind of time. And it's just more for me, really, than anything else. I might not even put this bit in. But it was more just, for me, when I hear that riff, for some reason, I immediately leap to The Inbetweeners. And I don't know if that's just something that in my head, or whether that's a riff that they used in the program.
Yeah, no, it might well be. Because Inbetweeners is a couple of years younger, and I think Inbetweeners sort of came along 2008-09, didn't it? I think.
Yeah.
So, but no, I honestly don't know. You'll have to Google it.
I think I will. I think I will, and I will let you know.
If Google doesn't have the answer, then nothing knows.
Well, exactly. So the song is often rated very highly when we're looking back at the band's career, with fans and critics alike. What is it about this song for you that's just proved so popular over the years?
I think it's probably more because it's more relationship-y, sort of the beginning of one anyway, and sort of that oh great, she's off on one again and I've done something wrong again. Do you know what I mean? I think like a lot of people can relate to it at times, obviously looking at past relationships and things like that.
And it's one, sort of, I think it's one of the only ones, really, that they do. They don't really talk about relationships and sort of love and romance like that. Mm. Not in this sense, anyway.
And I guess that's the thing we've somewhat, compared to the rest of the album, we've almost fast-forwarded a few weeks or a few months after that crazy Saturday night, and we're now navigating the pitfalls of the moody girlfriend, the Mardi yeah. bum. And yet, funnily enough, it's when I was talking to people that, like, sort of couples and family members that I knew that we were doing this album, a lot of the couples were like, oh, we love Mardi Bum. It's almost as if it was their song.
It's relatable. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That's what I mean as well.
Which I think must be kind of testament, again, to the songwriting. Because, you know, a song about kind of the moody girlfriend, and yet the moody girlfriend has no issue with the song and really likes it. That's got to be some good songwriting.
Yeah, but I suppose also it talks to both. I mean, the boyfriend might think it's a girlfriend, and the girlfriend might think it's the boyfriend. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no specific sort of direction as to who it's pointed at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it could be the girlfriend saying this out loud to the boyfriend rather than the boyfriend thinking it to the girlfriend. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's sort of relatable to both genders more than anything.
Cool. So we'll move on to the next track, another great name. And I've been sort of collecting some of my favourite song names throughout the podcast. And obviously our next one is Perhaps Vampires is a bit strong, but... ...
Yeah.
which is up there with kind of Subterranean Homesick Alien on OK Computer. Like, there's certain names that I think just really... I just enjoy, and that's one of them. So while the album is held in really high regard otherwise, we wouldn't be discussing it, I struggled to find a lot of critical thought or opinion on this particular track. So I was curious what your thoughts are on the track, and is it kind of a hidden gem, or as close to filler as we get on the album, or is it kind of a fan favourite of the band's fans?
I don't know, it's one of my favourites. I don't know necessarily it's one of everybody else's favourites. I wouldn't say, but in my opinion, there aren't any fillers on the album, or it's close to. They're all solid. They're just, some of them are very different. My favourite bit about this particular song is when you assume the song's over, and it goes silent for 3 or 4 seconds, and then it all kicks back in again. Personally, I quite like that. That's what I like about that song.
Yeah. You don't want to fall asleep with that one on.
No, you sort of, you assume it's over, and you go, oh, that was really good. And then all of a sudden, it sort of kicks back in, and you go, whoa, this is really good. I think without that last sort of bit, I don't think it would, like I said, maybe it would have been a filler, maybe it would have been one of those, oh, it's all right. But I think it sort of just helps it along.
I mean, interesting, you saying it's one of your favourites. I'd say, obviously, when I was talking to my wife about this album, this is one of her favourites. This is one of the ones that because she was a fan of Arctic Monkeys when we met, and this was one of the first songs that she played me, so it's obviously one of her favourites too. Do you think it's just a case of it maybe being sandwiched between Mardi Bum and When the Sun Goes Down, that perhaps potentially by some it gets forgotten?
Yeah, it could, yeah. Yeah, I can't disagree with that at all. I mean, it's in between two of their biggest songs. it's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a case of being forgotten. Whereas if people actually sat down and listened to it, I think they'd appreciate it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. So we'll move on to When the Sun Goes Down, our next track. It's another number one for the band.
Yeah.
And it was released a week before the album was released. So it sold over 400,000 copies. And this is all ignoring the fact that it's about the prostitution scene in Sheffield. So... Again, it's surely testament to the band that they can take a subject as seedy as prostitution and make a number one single out of it.
Yeah, I didn't realize it sold that many copies. That's an incredible amount of singles to sell.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that includes downloads, kind of cumulatively since, but that's kind of the figure we're at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it's one of their earlier songs as well. Like I said earlier, originally it was called Scummy Man, and the record label said you can't release that. People aren't going to buy a song called Scummy Man. Otherwise, not they weren't allowed to. Sort of, I don't know if it'd get played, maybe, you know what radio stations can be like with some lyrics and things like that. But no, it's a top tune. It's an incredible, again, it's going back, sort of, some of it is just good rock music with good lyrics. And this is, in my opinion, this is sort of Turner at one of his best with his poetry. His rhyming is just absurd. It's just amazing.
And it's, for me, it's the strongest, one of the strongest examples on the album of kind of this vivid imagery that's throughout the whole album. And it's probably got my favourite lyric on the album, which isn't particularly clever or particularly funny, But it's just, they said it changes when the sun goes down around here, which is just foreshadowing the shady activity that happens in this district of Sheffield at night.
Yeah, definitely. We've all, every city's got one, isn't it?
So the song, in fact, inspired the movie, well, a short film or a film, Scummy Man, starring Lauren Sosher and Stephen Graham, a shorter version of which made up the music video for When the Sun Goes Down. Have you seen Scummy Man, or at the very least the video, the music video that they made from the film?
Yeah, I've got it. I've got the DVD.
Is that for of Scummy Man?
Yes, it came in like a white book, almost, like a hardback book idea.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, what's that like? Is the band's music in the film, or is it just kind of inspired by that song?
The music's in there. I haven't seen it for years. It's in the loft somewhere.
Mm.
I've got tons of old Arctic Monkey stuff that is sort of, in my head, it's like, you know, my precious. So I've got all their early singles and everything. It sort of gets pension pot one day, maybe. Mm. From what I remember, I'm pretty sure it's got the song in it, if I can remember rightly.
Cool.
Because I haven't seen it for years. I should dig it out, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah. Strange, I can remember what the cover's like.
So we'll move on to the next track, which is From the Ritz to the Rubble. So again, it's another spot-on account of your average British night out. I feel like everyone has had that bouncer who just takes a sudden dislike to you for absolutely no reason at all. So a thought that may come to mind for some detractors of the album, and I must say now that this isn't my thought, but it's an interesting point to debate nonetheless, whether the voice on the album, in terms of the lyrical voice rather than the physical voice, is a genuine one. Were Alex Turner and the band, were they the boys out every weekend living every word of these songs, or do you think Turner's simply, at that point, a very astute observer of British culture at that time?
No. Well, yeah, he was, but no. I think a lot of this is autobiographical, to be honest. I think they were out every weekend, and they were playing sort of every weekend as well. I think they came across a few situations themselves, and I wouldn't be surprised if this was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be surprised if this is a first-hand account.
So I think we've just got enough time to just go into our final track, which is A Certain Romance. Now, during a game of word association with NME, I believe, the word that Alex Turner chose to use regarding this song was classic.
Yeah.
NME listed it in their 100 tracks of the decade. Yeah. And all the articles and lists that I've encountered during my research place A Certain Romance very near the top, if not at the top. So all of these accolades, and then you remember that it wasn't really even a single. How important is this song for the enduring success of the album?
Oh, very. Extremely important. I think in 30 years' time, when they're sort of, Rolling Stones royalty sort of touch, this will be one that gets played. I think this is going to be one of their songs that is just associated with them forever. It's not going to be one that people are going to forget.
And it's funny that we were just talking about the notion of like the voice being genuine rather than just kind of just being sort of savvy to culture at the time. Because it's almost like with this whole album, we've been very much in the thick of it. Kind of we've been with them on this journey out on the Raz all weekend. Where by A Certain Romance, it's as if we're kind of off to one side and we're saying that things are changing and that we're growing up a bit.
Yeah, it could be.
And I mean, The Guardian kind of went into this in a little more detail. They said, if anything, it's about acceptance, a song that documents unease about a culture in decline and being part of a generation approaching adulthood. So with that in mind, could A Certain Romance be the band saying goodbye to those years where they were out every weekend and the crazy tours and all the drinking, but foreshadowing the future, which was kind of their success as a rock band?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, can't disagree with that. I mean, The Guardian, one good thing about those sort of newspapers is their music reviews generally are pretty spot on, like you say, so, especially for things like this. Yeah, because it's sort of, isn't it, 2006, because what was it, classic Reebok tracky bottoms tucked in their socks, isn't it? And back then there was a lot of that going on. Yeah, I think it's about sort of leaving that behind, leaving Sheffield behind, as they did in the end. And like I say, yeah, sort of a goodbye. Because after this album, they said that they wouldn't do anything similar to this again. I seem to think it was some long lines of, we were into dance music before we were into the Strokes, I think was roughly the sort of the lines that they came out with at the time. So yeah, it probably was sort of a vibe, we were growing up. and that's that. Sort of similar to, have you ever heard The Enemy's debut album?
Yeah.
It's that sort of, a certain romance and a lot of that album sort of tie in for me. It's sort of that sort of growing up, sort of, we've done that, we've been to school, we've gone out for the nights out, we've seen all this, right, what's next? What's next in the adventure of our lives? And especially in Arctic Monkey's case, I don't think there's many tracky bottoms tucked in socks where they belong now.
I know, I wouldn't have thought so. So, it's an album that's defined a generation, and it continues to get critical and commercial plaudits for the past 11 years. I'm going to phrase this question differently than I normally would. How do you think this album will stand the test of time?
It will be up there with the best. It, obviously, I'm biased because it's my favourite album, but no, I think, yeah, it's going to be up there with the best. It's going to be up there with the, like, you know, the greatest albums ever. You sort of talk about sort of like The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead, Ziggy Stardust, The Wall, or Dark Side of the Moon. I think it's going to be up there, definitely. Purely on lyrical merit alone, taking aside even how well things are played, I think just lyrically alone, it's going to be up there.
And finally, why is Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, your classic album, and why should people check it out?
It was amazing. That's why.
That's the most succinct answer.
If you've never heard it before, you will hear it, and as we touched on quite a bit, you will. It's talking to you. You will hear it, and you will go, oh, I remember, like you were saying, I remember being at that age and being on the dance floor and not wanting to talk to the girls, so dancing a bit rubbish. So it transports you back, and there's not an awful lot of albums that actually do that. Like even the biggest albums that sort of are around from like the 70s and the 60s, they don't always talk to you necessarily about your life. They're just incredibly well made. Whereas this is slightly raw around the edges, but it talks to you. Every track is just talks to you and is about your life.
Well, Ben, thank you very much for taking the time out to speak to us. I've had a great time. So thank you very much. And yeah, hopefully speak to you very soon.
Yes, hopefully. Cool.
So a special thanks to Ben Dumbreck for taking time out of his busy schedule to sit with me and chat about his classic album, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. And of course, Ben had a lot of choice, not just because there's so many classic albums out there, but because he runs his own record shop, Inner Groove Records. So if you get yourself over to www.innergrooverecords.co.uk, or you search for Inner Groove Records on Facebook, Ben has loads of fantastic singles and albums from over the years that are available for you to buy. Some of the albums that have been covered on my classic album are there. And I know that when I go to buy Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, to join my collection of classic albums, I will be buying it from Ben. So get yourself over to www.facebook.com/innergrooveuk or over to www.innergrooverecords.co.uk and you'll see everything that he has there. Don't forget to like the page and, of course, let him know that my classic album sent you. And that'll just about do us for another episode of the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that you'll dig out Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, and give it a listen. There's some really great guests coming up with some fantastic classic albums that they've chosen over the next few months, so keep yourself on the Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages to find out more about that, and of course over at myclassicalbum.co.uk, where you'll get all the latest information about what's happening with the podcast. So until June the 1st, when our next episode goes online, have a great time. And I'll see you then. Cheers.